Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federalist Society's Free Speech and Election Law Practice Group, was recorded on Wednesday, May 27, 2015, during a live telephone conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members.
Well, good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group telephone conference call on the book, Political Realism, How Hacks, Machines, Big Money, and Backroom Deals Can Strengthen American Democracy. My name is Christian Corgan, and I'm the Director of Publications here at the Federalist Society. As always, please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call, and also that this call is being recorded for use as a podcast in the future. Today, I'm pleased to welcome from the Pillar of Law Institute, Stephen R. Klein, who is going to introduce the book and the author and tell you a little bit more about the topic and what we're going to be discussing today. So without any further ado, Steve Klein, the floor is yours.
Thanks a lot, Christian, and thanks to everyone for joining us on today's call. On May 1st, the Brookings Institution released Jonathan Rauch's latest work, Political Realism, How Hacks, Machines, Big Money, and Backroom Deals Can Strengthen American Democracy. This short read is available for free as an ebook through Amazon and most other ebook outlets, and I highly recommend you download a copy. But don't just take my word for it. Today we're happy to welcome Jonathan Rauch. A journalist and senior fellow at the Brookings Institution, Mr. Rauch brings to this book decades of thought and experience within the American experiment. John, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you, Steve. It's great to be here. And did we mention the ebook is totally free?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Can't go wrong. Just to start off, I mean, what is political realism and why should learned Federalists care about it?
Two very different questions. Political realism is a couple things. One is it's a sort of gathering trend among scholars and practitioners that says a lot of the assumptions that the reforms of the last 40 or so years have been based on are not entirely correct, that they're too idealistic and too legalistic, and actually have been counterproductive in many ways. So it's a group of kind of people that are rising up, but it's also a point of view. Different people would express it different ways, but I think one column element is that realists believe that governing is inherently difficult. It's just really, really hard. You can't take it for granted. And that in order to govern, you have to have transactional politics. That's the give and take of people who make deals and bargains and work stuff out with each other through negotiation and compromise in ways pleasant and unpleasant, and that if a system doesn't allow room for transactional compromise or systematically strips away the room for it, it's not going to function very well. So those are parts of the framework. Others are to be suspicious of idealistic reforms and big claims, to generally prefer incrementalism, and to always ask about trade-offs. We live in a second and third choice world, and it's always important to ask the question if you're talking about the role of big money, for example, compared to what? So all of those are elements of the puzzle.
Yeah, as a practitioner, certainly over the years, the idealism, and I've worked in campaign finance law for about 7 years now, and the idealism has always been tempered by the rubber hitting the road. And I appreciate that I've worked on from a constitutional perspective, seeing that these, whether an intended or unintended consequences, they tend to harm free speech, particularly campaign finance laws. You've taken kind of a more objective and realistic approach to say this, that these reforms just simply, not only, you know, aside from their ill effects, they've actually haven't really even gone toward accomplishing their goals. And yet, you go even farther than that, though, and it's particularly the subtitle. We have hacks, machines, big money. Is a lot of this just a case of throwing the baby out with the bathwater over the years?
Well, that's pretty much what I argue, that over the past several decades, we've seen the rise of three different groups of reformers, which have very little in common in many cases, except for their belief that transactional politics is one way or another corrupt. You know, this is politicians trading stuff, often in back rooms, negotiating, dealing. Often they're professionals, and so forth. I argue that a very strange bedfellows combination of progressives who believe that decisions should be made meritocratically in the public interest, and populists who believe that decisions should be made out in the open democratically by the public, and not by professionals and not in private places. And then libertarians, which may be of interest to this group, who believe that political decision-making and transacting is inherently corrupt and flawed because, in their view, it's a move away from market decision-making, which they see as more fair and more efficient. And that all of these groups, for different reasons, have promoted a reform agenda that has stacked the deck against hacks, machines, big money, backroom deals, all of which, to some extent, you actually need to make government work.
Particularly looking at the what you mentioned is that the libertarian school of campaign finance, and it's at least its ostensible goal of eliminating rent seeking. I wonder when I look at, you know, for example, whether it's backroom deals or even specifically you discuss, for example, that the elimination of earmarking in the Congress was a bad thing, or that the elimination or other reforms. When I look at those, or even when we talk about machines, we talk about parties being able to grant favors or to largesse to a certain extent, whether through that or through earmarking. I wonder if is that kind of a much broader critique against libertarianism? Because if those are allowed to occur for government to function, isn't it antithetical to the libertarian idea that to shrink government and keep it as small as possible?
Well, it depends on what kind of libertarian you are. If you're an idealistic libertarian and you imagine that the comparator for the world that we're in right now is a world with no government or radically smaller government, and a world where decision-making is rarely, if ever, political, which I think some people do have in their heads as the baseline they would like to get to, then yeah, my vision is, in fact, fundamentally anti-libertarian, because it says there's no getting around politics in society, and in fact you need politics. It's how you keep society stable. And I'd even argue, in contrast to my earlier self, in a book that's not free that I still recommend, it's called Demosclerosis, otherwise known as Government Sense, that rent seeking has its legitimate place because it brings lots of people to the table to transact what political scientists call issue-free resources, and that got many downsides in the form of inefficiency and, yes, sometimes corruption. But it's also a wonderful guarantor of stability, because people who are at the table dickering over farm benefits are not out throwing bombs, and that's important. But there's another kind of libertarian, and that would be, you know, for example, a guy named like Jerry Taylor at the Niskanen Institute, or John Samples at the Cato Institute. And I think these people understand that politics is with us for good, and that you can do a lot for a libertarian smaller government agenda working through politics. You can't get the whole way there. That's not how politics works. But I think people who are less utopian about it will find that there's a lot they can do in the political system, and that it's actually, if you look at the entitlement state and its autopilot growth, it's not really a good idea to just obstruct and let all of that grow out of control.
So when it comes right down to it, certainly over the last few elections, and whether we're looking at populist movements, whether on the left as the Occupy Wall Street or on the right as the Tea Party, there seems to be a certain, I think you could safely say, anger across the political spectrum in certain corners, and people seem to be very upset that they're not getting their way. Is it just sort of do you think citizens perhaps need to accept that there is a solution, but it does just take time and far more prolonged involvement than, say, a protest over near Wall Street or a gathering in the local park?
Well, different people are upset about different things. A lot of people are upset about the dysfunction that they see in Washington, and rightly so. You know, when a single senator can effectively shut down the U.S. government, or really in many ways very good productive budget deal gets shot down by a minority of a single caucus, something really is wrong. So if people are upset about that, then my claim is that political machines are part of the answer, not part of the problem. And we'll talk about that soon, I hope. If people are upset because they don't like politics, then I think part of what I'm trying to do in this book is say, get used to it. We live in a political world, and this is a good thing, actually, not a bad thing. We're fortunate to be in a place where we have functioning politics. And the question should be not how to go further in dismantling the mechanisms that politicians use to make these trades and do these deals and get followers to follow leaders. It's actually how to strengthen those things.
For those who may have called in late, we're speaking with Jonathan Rauch about his new book, Political Realism, How Hacks, Machines, Big Money, and Backroom Deals Can Strengthen American Democracy. And again, it's available for free download as an ebook through Amazon and many other outlets. Well, you mentioned it, so I guess I'd ask you to expand upon it. What are the benefits of machines? Is it just synonymous with a political party, or does it go farther beyond that? Or is it Tammany Hall, or is there somewhere in between what we have today and Tammany that is, you think, workable?
Yeah, so here's where the rubber meets the road in this book. My argument is that in order to have government that works, you need to have political machines or things like them, and they need to work. And the reason is that in the American system, as every member of the Federalist Society knows, we have a lot of dispersed centers of power, and politicians have almost no direct authority over one another in distinction to a parliamentary system. And that means in order to get stuff done, we rely on informal political organizations and structures, which parties are, of course, the big ones and the most important ones, or should be. But there are others that are not synonymous with parties. For example, the committee structures on Capitol Hill in many ways functioned as bipartisan political machines for many years and quite successfully. So what's a political machine? Well, it's a network or hierarchy of mutual political accountability. It's a kind of favor trading economy between politicians so that they're accountable to each other for certain results, and they've got roles that they expect to play, and they can put out favors and call in favors. And the ones closer to the top can do things, usually incentives, but sometimes punishments, to incentivize behavior among other politicians that can get people working together. So that's what you need to do if you want to pass a controversial reform, like Medicare reform, for example, or whatever. So these unofficial systems involve stuff like earmarks, where you give out favors. They involve secrecy, privacy, because the only way that you can really do a deal with a lot of complicated elements is to lay lots of those elements on the table, talk about everything. Nothing is settled until everything is settled, and you can't do that in public. Another thing you need is repeat players, because if someone's going to be a loser in the deal today, they need to know they might be the winner in the next deal. You know, you're not going to get this one, but you will get the next one. And that conversation means you need to have professionals who are going to be there for a while, who are going to be accountable for continued results over time. So that's back rooms and that's hacks. You need to be able to move money around so that if someone takes a hard vote for the team, you can protect them in their primary to the extent you can by moving a lot of money behind them. So that's where big money can come in handy. Machines are the factories where deals get done and compromises get made and enforced. When we take them apart, as I'd argue we've done, we can go to that next. You get a situation where John Boehner, the Speaker of the House, is more afraid of his caucus than he is of them. He made a very poignant statement about this on the Jay Leno show, of all places, when he was asked why one senator, basically a small minority of Republicans, was able to shut down the government. He said, I looked around, and a leader without followers is just a man taking a walk. The result of being in this situation is not that we have a crisis of leadership. It's we have a crisis of followership. There's very little that politicians can do anymore to incentivize each other. So that's kind of what I argue is the core of the problem.
Now, and I wondered, especially as I read it, and you do a pretty good summary of certain history, and we can always go back, you know, the the founders famously warned against faction. Numerous writings, you know, warn us that the ideal was to not do this, and yet parties seem to be the first natural outcropping post constitution that came up very quickly. And it seems over the years, and you know, going back to my practice, a lot of particularly campaign finance reform played a large role in watering down the power of parties. And lo and behold, what happened? But now I guess you could call them micro machines have popped up all over the, whether it's super PACs, whether it's social, you know, 501c4 groups. Now they're very, very dispersed. On the other hand, and you certainly have trade organizations haven't gone anywhere, you know, and corporations. It just seems now just so dispersed that we've ended up in the situation we're in.
Yeah, there have been a series of reforms, and the guiding spirit behind many of them is that the more politics is moved away from professionals and hacks, as I call them, into the hands of purists and amateurs, the more pure politics will be, and the more it's moved into democratic decision-making and participation by ordinary people, the purer and better it will be, and that you should try to quarantine politicians for money and move money out of politics. Well, it turns out when you move money out of accountable actors like party and candidates and make it harder, especially for parties to raise money, the money goes somewhere else. It goes to less accountable places. The only thing I really take issue with in the statement you just made, Steve, is the use of the word micro machines. There is nothing micro about what I call the shadow machines now. These are very large organizations accountable essentially to nobody. There's, you know, no way you can like vote against the Koch brothers. And they're much less willing to compromise because they're interest-driven. They're not as interested in governing because that's not their responsibility. To me, in a way, the first and best statement of political realism was 30 years ago when I was starting out as a journalist in Washington. A professional Senate staff member named Sid Brown told me what I think of as Brown's Law, which is if you tell a politician he cannot do something that he thinks he needs to do, he will always find a way to do it. And I think that's a good deal of what we've learned in the last 40 or so years.
Yeah, already 20 years ago in the National Journal in 1997, you wrote, probably no American public policy is a more comprehensive failure than campaign finance law. And you went on to describe a two-pronged approach to having public financing, rapid disclosure, and then importantly, no other rules besides those. Today, public financing seems dead or dormant at the federal level, while disclosure is at best certainly a can of worms and a big part of my work. Do you believe this two-prong approach is still worthwhile?
I still like the idea in principle, but there's now so much private money out there that I think it would probably swamp any amount of public financing that you're likely to come up with. So I no longer think that solution is timely.
But really just shoring up the parties then is still a feasible solution, because it does seem we've seen some changes late last year that have already apparently borne fruit, that the parties are starting to see more money head their way.
Yeah, here's the good news, which is that people say, can you put this genie back into the bottle? And they'll give you a million reasons why today is not like Tammany Hall and why Tammany Hall was bad. And I agree with all of that. We don't want to go back to Tammany. We couldn't if we wanted to. Today is very different. All kinds of reasons fill in the gap. But here's the good news. This is, in my view, is not like putting the genie back in the bottle. It's like, how do you make the grass grow again? Well, you let it grow. It turns out that organizing their world, which is what we're really talking about, what machines and machine politics and this give and take and transaction, creating networks and incentives, that's what politicians naturally do if you let them. There have been a series of changes which, in my view, have stacked the deck against leaders and insiders in favor of purists and outsiders. And I think a lot of what we can do is just start undoing some of that. One reform that people talk about, which I find persuasive, for example, is the idea of simply lift all limits on contributions to political parties. I might go further and lift all limits on contributions to senior congressional leaders and committee chairmen. And the notion of that is to bring more of that money inside the most accountable and sort of big thinking actors that we've got, which are the parties, and make more of those resources available to leaders. I think it's more accountable inside than outside. And I suspect that that kind of reform would also help give those people more of the tools that they need to govern. We know from some empirical work that Raymond LaRaja and Brian Schaffner are about to publish, and others, that state legislatures, states that have sort of, they call it party-centered finance systems, where a lot of the money flows to parties instead of candidates, have less polarized legislatures. And although you can't be sure, the plausible story about why that's true is that it's not that partisans or parties are moderate, but they've got to keep winning elections over time. So when the money flows to them, they're going to try to steer it to candidates who have broad appeal and are closer to the median voter. So for many reasons, this kind of thinking is beginning to get new traction. But there are other things. Like, no other country in the world picks its political nominees by a vote of extremist partisans, which is what primary contests very often come down to. And there's no law that says we have to do it that way. So there's interesting conversations about changes to the primary structure. Probably the most single important informal mechanism that hacks and machines used and still use when they can to incentivize and protect their people is control of the ballot. You know, that's some assurance, not perfect assurance, but some assurance that if you take one for the team, you'll get protected from a primary challenge. There's interesting ways to do that. Stanford Law School's Nathaniel Persily has a very interesting idea, which is indicate on the ballot, in the primary ballot, which candidate is preferred by the party leadership. Just put it on there, party preferred. Give the voters the information. Up to you how you vote, but if you want to vote for the person who we think will take one for the team, this is the person to go with. Brand new idea, very interesting, and symbolic, I think, of the kind of fresh thinking we're starting to see.
Very good. I think now certainly have a few more questions, but Christian, I think it's a great time to maybe open the line up for people who might be interested in asking Mr. Rausch some questions.
All right. Well, in a moment to ask a question, you'll hear a prompt that will say the floor mode is on. And after that, to request the floor, enter star and then the pound key. So again, to ask a question of our speakers, press star and then the pound key. It looks like we did have our first question, a couple questions jump on. So, Steve, if you're ready, we can go right to those.
Fire away.
All right.
Hi, my name is Mike. I'm a Federalist Society member out here in California. And I'm somewhat troubled by what I'm hearing from you, that we want to continue the status quo as to where we're going. And what concerns me the most is where you have people like Mitch McConnell outright lie, promising to do certain things in order to get elected, but then when he's in power, he fails to deliver. And so what we have here is the continuous bait and switch, and basically furthering the central GOP approach to, you know, what they want, irrespective of what the voters want, so that they utilize opportunities to mislead individuals to vote for them, and yet there's no accountability, or to the extent there is accountability, they repeat what they're going to do again and not do it. And I think that's a real problem we have. And it's not only Mitch McConnell, it's the Boehner problem as well.
Well, I disagree with the premise. I think American politicians work extremely hard to fulfill their promises. And they've got a lot of equities to consider, especially a guy like Boehner or McConnell. If the idea is that those guys are not accountable and do whatever they want to do, regardless of what folks think, I don't really see it. I do see folks who wish they had more leadership tools than they had and who would like to be able to use, in many cases, a stronger hand in a deeply divided caucus. But I guess we're kind of living with very different viewpoints about that. And I guess I'd also wonder, so what's the alternative? If you think like every politician that's out there breaks promises and no good, where does that leave us? I'd like to look for ways that help these guys be in a position where they can keep their promises. But I'm kind of troubled by the streak I hear increasingly from my libertarian friends of kind of an obstructionism of they're all crooks, they're all terrible, politics is hopeless. Where do you go with that?
I mean, I'm trying to figure out what we can do with this. I have no problem lifting all of the campaign finance restrictions. I think that those have created far more problems than they've resolved. And frankly, I'm not sure any of them, irrespective of what the Supreme Court says, is, in my opinion, are constitutional and consistent with the First Amendment, but I'm not in that position. I'm just troubled by the ability of politicians to get finances in from across the nation and may not be living or voting consistent with their constituents that reside in their geographical area. And I don't know that there is anything that can be done with it. I'm just kind of frustrated with what I see going on with the Republican Party, where there's all of these promises made, we're going to repeal Obamacare, we're going to deal with amnesty, and then they immediately capitulate on the budget as well. And so what do you do? I mean, when you have the Chamber of Commerce...
I can give you my recommendation, but I think you'll find it unappealing, and you'll probably walk away unsatisfied and won't take it, which is you're never going to get the impossible out of politics, and you're never going to get the perfect out of politics. There aren't the votes to repeal Obamacare. There's not a consensus to do it. No politician could deliver it. So my suggestion would be think a little bit harder about what's actually doable and work sort of in an incrementalist way to move closer to that goal. But imagining a world of like either no politics or an environment where politicians can snap their fingers and Obamacare goes away, it's to me... The beginning of political realism is playing the ball where it lies and understanding the only way out is through. So I tell my libertarian friends, like, get better at politics. Don't shun it and don't throw up your hands.
Well, this is Christian Corrigan. This is proving to be a popular topic. We actually have 5 questions pending, so we
okay.
can go
I'll
right
try
now.
To be, I'll try to be briefer.
Oh, no problem. This is a great discussion. So let's go to the next one.
Hey, good afternoon. This is Mike Doherty in Atlanta. This is a great, great talk. I appreciate your time, and I actually downloaded the book already. As a hack, non-lawyer member of the Federal Society that has been forced to deal with Congress in the past 2 years, somewhat successfully, I will the prior caller's perspective has kind of changed my question a little bit, because I share that view a lot, but then I see then I get involved with them in Congress, like I've had the past 6 months especially, and I have a little bit more empathy. I think we've forgotten that Congress is supposed to be messy and hard, and it's supposed to be hard to make law. So it's hard to reverse law as well. What do you think about the general populace's theory of what Congress is supposed to be versus the true intent of how it was built? I think that's where there's a big problem here, even for myself. And I've been much more effective with it in that way. I don't know if you could speak to that, because I think the education of your ideas is real important for everyone to get.
Yeah, thank you. So it sounds like you're someone who actually had to lobby an issue and try to get something through and got some sense of the cross pressures that these people are under from day to day. Politics is a really, really hard job. And a lot of people on both the left and the right, actually, I see this just as much among my libertarian friends as among my progressive friends, have this idea that if the politicians, if the self-serving politicians and the greedy interest groups would just get out of our way, they're like these big, obvious solutions out there just waiting to be grabbed and instituted. Some people even wrote a book about this a few years ago on how so many Americans want to be governed by what they call NSIDs, enlightened, non-self-interested decision makers. You know, whether you think that's the market or if you're a libertarian or a bureaucrat, if you're a progressive, doesn't really matter, because they both think if it weren't for politics, we could get this right. And political realism says, no, that's the opposite of the answer. Actually, really in real life, the only way, these are very difficult, socially contentious questions. We're in fact lucky not to be in a constant state of war over them, as, you know, think about Syria, Iraq, lots of other places, or tyrannically oppressed, which is the other way to deal with it. We're lucky to be in a situation where we can negotiate, compromise, and try to work out imperfect solutions. That's what the Constitution is framed to do. It's a compromise-forcing mechanism. At bottom, everything else aside, that is what Madison's structure is designed to do, force people to compromise with other people if they want to play the game and get any results. And I say again and again, this is a game that libertarians, no one ever wins forever, but libertarians can make a lot of real headway. And so I urge them to play it. I think politics is part of the solution more than it is the problem.
Well, we still have now five questions pending, so and still a half hour of time to go, so we'll go right to it.
Hi, my name is Margaret Little. I'm a practicing attorney in Connecticut. I was curious about what changed your mind. You had indicated there was an earlier book that you sort of evolved from, and I was wondering whether it was reporting, participating in politics, just talking with people, reading something. I'm interested in what brought you to this realistic view.
Oh, I'm glad to be asked that question, because I've been thinking about that very thing. My earlier work in the 90s was about how in societies over time, interest groups and special interest claims accumulate, and how as those things lock in subsidies and programs built on top of one another, which are almost never repealed, government becomes sclerotic, loses the ability to adapt. Even at the time, I acknowledged in passing that there's an upside to all this interest group activity, but I said very little about it because I was in kind of a different place. So what changed? That, by the way, was an advertisement for my earlier books, which it's called Government's End, Why Washington Stopped Working, available on Amazon for like $12. Was that enough of a blatant pitch? So that one's not free.
I believe in capitalism.
You'll love it. It's public choice and lots of stuff like that. Rent seeking, all of that stuff is in there. So a big thing that opened my eyes was a few years ago, John Boehner in the House and Harry Reid in the Senate and Barack Obama negotiated a budget deal, which was a pretty damn good budget deal, I thought, in a flawed world, and actually would have done something about Medicare, which is our biggest spending problem, as you probably know. And it did involve a component of tax increases. But if that had gone to the floor, it would have gotten through Congress, both houses, on a solid majority, and the public would have liked it. There was a lot of support in the Republican Party, a whole lot. Boehner wanted to do it. He thought it was in the party's interest. The Democrats, Obama wanted to do it. So we have situations in this country where there's just not enough agreement to move ahead. Happens all the time. But there are other situations where there is agreement to move ahead. But what happened with the budget deal is that John Boehner went back to his caucus and could not get enough people lined up behind it. There was a loud enough minority of opposition so that he did not feel he could get it to the floor. And he didn't want to pass it with mainly Democratic votes. And he had virtually, I watched him, he was almost totally helpless. He could plead, he could beg, he would say, I think this is really important, but there's very little he could do. So he had to go back, and basically the whole thing fell apart. He walked away, Instead, we got this nutty sequester thing that we now have, which just delays the entitlement problem. Then we saw the same thing happen on immigration reform, which would have been, in my opinion, a good thing. Majority support, rank and file of both parties. We saw a similar dynamic play out with the shutting of the government and the shutting of the Homeland Security Department. And I began to realize the problem isn't lack of consensus in the country. The problem now is even when there is a consensus and both parties want to do something, it's virtually impossible in many cases for leaders to organize their followers. And I began to think, you know, this is a different and more immediate kind of dysfunction than the sort of long-term buildup that I'm thinking about. And I was thinking about earmarks, too. You all know what earmarks are. They're these little pork barrel programs that go in appropriations bills, and they're gimmies for members of Congress. But it turns out they're really useful ways to help people take tough votes, like, you know, you want to reform Medicare. That's really controversial. There are lots of old people in my district. But, hey, you're going to get that new airport one, Ray. So a lot of people like that. Those were abolished in a fit of sanctimony. I looked at that and said, so when you take away all the tools, or so many of the tools that leaders need to lead, where do you wind up? But if you had to narrow it down, I'd say it was that the lost opportunity for a budget deal that really started me thinking on this other track.
Thank you.
Thank you.
All right. We still have four questions pending.
Hello, this is Derek Hora. I'm a Federal Society member out in Virginia. And my question is more with the general tenor of this discussion. What I've been hearing has been discussing issues in national politics. And my question is how you reconcile this with the notion of each representative representing in a lot of our regional interests, and how the sort of national approach seems to be potentially more consistent with a different form of portioning representation that might be more, that might be more conducive to working together on a national sphere, but would have a very detrimental impact on regional representation.
What a great question. To me, one of the most important strengths of political machines, which, by the way, doesn't necessarily mean big city urban machines. It means any of these informal organizations that are able to incentivize people, create mutual accountability. One of their great strengths is they can do complicated negotiations. It's very hard for individual people in our system to do a complicated negotiation just out there on their own. It's very hard to organize that. And it's also very hard to organize between different levels of interest, things like local, state, regional, federal, things like rural versus urban, ethnic interests, and so on. The best way to do that is to have a fairly large encompassing network that can do complicated trades among lots of different factions. And that's, to go back to the point that Steve made earlier, I think that's a key reason that parties developed. And it's also a key reason that in so many governing, so many areas, you've seen the development of these networks that look like political machines and so on. That's their business, to make trades between different levels and different people and say things like, you know, in this farm bill, it looks like we're going to be spending more money for the wheat farmers, and that's really good for the Midwest. So what are we going to do about food stamps for the Northeast? But wait a minute. If you do both of those things, you exceed the budget. So where can we cut over here? You go cut over there, crop insurance, and someone squawks, and you say to that person, well, hang on a minute. If you take this deal, next time we're going to look at something else that needs to get done. So The problem is when you hold this stuff up to the light individually and in the bright light of day, it sounds corrupt, right? It's log rolling, horse trading. We're supposed to hate that. Politics is supposed to be clean of that kind of, you know, grubby exchange. But in fact, what's really going on there is social conciliation, diverse interests being brought together to negotiate and see if they can work something out. And that's just crucially important in politics. And no, none of us, the results are never clean and never perfect. But the great doctrine of realists is compared to what?
All right, we still, let's see, we've got, a little less than 20 minutes, and can you hear? Sorry. Steve, are you there? And Jonathan, can you hear me? Sorry, I think we cut out here.
No, we're in.
Okay, go ahead.
We have any questions pending, Christian?
Yeah, we do. Let's see. We have three more currently pending.
Hello, this is Matt Skeen in Denver, Colorado. Hillary Clinton has been criticized for not believing in anything and having no principles. Is political realism something she could successfully run on? To say that her lack of conviction is a feature, not a bug. Could that be a compelling message?
Unfortunately, from my point of view, not from her point of view, it's not. Americans have a strong bent toward idealism in politics, and they want the vision thing and that sort of stuff. Of course, they then complain when you get a president like Barack Obama, who turns out not to be all that good at the wheeling and dealing of politics, and they carp about it. One of the real uphill battles of the point of view that I espouse, it feels to me like the gay marriage issue 20 years ago when I first got involved in advocating gay marriage. It's just really hard to come out and talk publicly and say, you know, maybe the problem is that we're too fixated on increasing participation, and that's actually reducing the role of professionals and insiders who we rely on to do this work year in and year out. And it's very hard to elect someone right now who says, well, you know, I believe in big and important ideas, but I'm also going to be really focused on working with Congress on the nuts and bolts, and often that's going to mean not having the vision thing. That's not what we want to hear. We believe we're people of great ideas and grand visions, and a lot of Americans still have, I think, unrealistic ideas of what reform can look like. Somehow if you elect the right person, you're going to magically fix what's wrong with Washington. I think we saw that in 2008 with the unrealistic expectations of Obama, and then they get cynical when reality sinks in. So I see my role is to kind of experiment and see if you can start to develop a public case that says, hey, everybody, adjust your expectations a little bit and try to remember that our grandparents and their generation were not fools and crooks. They understood some things about politics and about the here and now and about the dangers of too much idealism. But it's a super uphill battle, and I recognize that. All three of the major reform movements that I mentioned, progressive, populist, and libertarian, they don't agree on really much of anything between all three of them. Progressives and libertarians are kind of at each other's throats on almost everything. But the one thing they do agree on is machine politics, horse trading, backrooms, all that kind of stuff. It's corrupt. It's bad. It's not in the public interest. It needs to go away. So what you're up against here are the three dominant strands of American reform thinking. That said, I'm not totally pessimistic by any means. There's a lot of support in the academy for this position, and I suspect that if we asked Steve Klein, he'd say that there's some support for it in the world of practitioners. And I think a lot of people are starting to figure out there that what we're doing right now isn't working so terribly well. So I think their minds to be changed.
And this is Steve Klein. I'd certainly just weigh in on the I found it so interesting as I read this book, and it, going back to Matt's question, it just thinking, you know, not so much as a practitioner, but also as a state level lobbyist for 5 years, I certainly relate. But I thought as reading the book and agreeing with much of your arguments, I had to think that the first rule of political realism, if you're a politician, is pretty much Fight Club. You don't talk about political realism if you actually want to get anywhere.
Yeah, that's right. And in fact, it's a point I make in the book itself, that I took the term borrowed it from foreign policy realism. Barack Obama is a realist, basically, as was George H.W. Bush, who he's admired, and as are, I would argue, the plurality, if not outright majority, of the American public. But what is the one thing that foreign policy realists never run on? Realism. You can't talk that way because it sounds like you're abandoning your ideals and your hopes for the world. So the trick to being a realist is to figure out ways to implement realism while fusing it with enough passion and enough vision so that people will accept it. And that's really hard to do, especially when you're up against other philosophies, like in foreign policy, the idea, you know, humanitarian interventionism. Let's go save lives. Well, you know, who can be against that? But that's always a challenge for realism. It's what we all do at some level and what few of us will admit to.
All right. Well, we have two questions pending, and our lines will be open, and we've got just a little over 10 minutes left. So if you'd like to get in line to ask a question, press star and the pound key now.
Hi. In some ways, I consider myself a realist in that I know kind of all the pressures that go on, but I do think that, you know, it's good to have that idealism of saying, you know, that's where we want to go, and as long as we are voting to go an inch in that direction, that's a good thing and not a bad thing. It's heading the right way, as it were. And although these backroom deals, I guess, I know they occur, I kind of prefer the idea out in the open. I don't see why they can't negotiate in the open and say, you know, we vote this way, this is the way we think we should go, and, you know, if the House and the Senate don't agree or whatnot, they come to a negotiation and say, we have to take this that we don't like to get that we do like. I don't see why these kind of negotiations can't be more out in the open. On the other side of it, on some of the political money and trading backroom deals on that side, I have a problem with politicians trading their own benefits for themselves over their constituents. Where they'll say, I get more money into my PAC, whatever, get reelected, and in exchange, I'll trade the interests of my own citizens.
Well, a couple things about that. One is that these days, every citizen is represented by multiple interest groups. If you're an American, you know, you're getting Social Security or student loans or whatever. And another thing is that trading is how it works. It's how stuff gets done. I don't see that as selling people down the river, actually.
I don't understand trading, you know, bargaining. Different legislative trading. I understand that happens all the time. But trading political votes here for more campaign donations to your reelection campaign or something else like that.
Oh, yeah. That's a good example of why realism is hard to defend, because in a pure world, that wouldn't have to happen. Everyone would just do the right thing all the time. But here's the thing. Politicians urgently need to organize their world so they don't wake up every morning and face complete chaos. And one of the key ways you do that is by organizing your supporters, the people who give you money, in a kind of back and forth negotiation that says, you know, it ain't bribery, it's perfectly legal, and it should remain legal. But it doesn't look great either to say, well, you're a supporter of mine, and I'm a supporter of yours, and you're going to make a donation to me, and that's going to help keep me in office, and that's also going to give me a line to you. So if I need something from you, but also I can kind of keep you in line, right? Because we're going to be talking to each other. So I'm going to develop a whole constellation, this network of people who give to me, who I communicate with. They're going to be my base, and there's going to be a constant negotiation back and forth.
It's so one thing
you can hold up. You can hold up any. You can hold up any one of these things and say, "Well, this is unsavory," but that's a core element of what politics, what politicians just absolutely have to do. And yeah, their constituents are part of that. They don't stay elected very long if they don't serve what ultimately what a majority of their constituents wants. But they also have to organize their universe. And the idea that sort of Mr. Smith goes to Washington view, that they can just come in, vote their conscience pristinely, not worry about where the money's coming from, not worry about whether they're going to be challenged in a primary, all that stuff. Just not really happening. What was your first point? Though I wanted to say something about that. The first half you were, could you remind me?
Oh, our caller got timed out.
I believe he was, John, I think he was talking about I found it striking. He believes in idealism as an inch by inch toward where you want to go.
Oh, yeah. I was just going to say how much I agree with that. That's incrementalism is really the only way to get stuff done. But I try to remind people, you'd be surprised how much you can get done incrementally if you come back again and again, year after year. That can be hugely important, and it can make the difference between long-term having a sustainable Social Security program or not having one, or having a Medicare program that is market-oriented versus not market-oriented. If you come back and hit it again, moving toward, for example, school choice, something I've always favored. But you don't get this stuff overnight. You work on it little by little. The other thing he said that I just wanted to say something about was, why can't the negotiations all be public? We're having this debate right now with the Trans-Pacific Trade Partnership, which is being negotiated in private. And there's a very good reason for that. If any of it was public, the very first thing that would happen is the minute anyone puts an idea on the table, 1,000 interest groups would immediately shoot it down. And they'd immediately be raising money to defeat anyone who's for it. And no one would be able to look at the overall package and judge as a whole, because there'd never be a package. So this is why when Senator Elizabeth Warren demands that the entire negotiation be held in public, that's not really a pro-transparency view, in my opinion. That's an anti-trade view, because I think she knows perfectly well that in order for negotiations to happen, you have to have some space for grown-ups to talk about what they can and cannot do, where their limits are, make offers that are conditional on receiving things in return, and that kind of stuff.
All right. Well, we have one more question pending that we'll definitely have time to get to before the end of the call.
Hi, this is Tim Reinecke in Iowa. And as I understand it, our state Republican Central Committee has a policy that says they can't endorse candidates in a primary. And many county chairs follow the same rule. You'd mentioned earlier the party expressing its protection of incumbents through primary preferences. I was just wondering what your thought is on a rule that prohibits the party from making an explicit endorsement, although members of the state central committee can still be part of an interest group. Thank you.
Yeah, is that actually a rule? Like, would they get punished if they...
There's a resolution they passed, and a member recently resigned so that he could endorse someone.
See, that's just so weird and counterproductive. We have seen a trend in the last several decades toward parties being very reluctant to engage themselves in primaries, even to the point where if the local voters want to go with someone who's going to cost them a Senate seat, we saw this in Delaware, the party will go, okay, whatever. Our job is to be a rubber stamp. And some people like Tom Davis and Martin Frost, former congresspersons, one of each party, have said this is a behavior that parties need to rethink. If they want to stay viable long-term and win some of these races, they need to start thinking, well, you know, we've got to put a thumb on the scale sometimes. There may be backlash against that. You have to be really careful how you do it. But to say something like the professionals, the leaders, the elected officials, the people who are going to be there in the duration and live with the consequences and have to govern based on these decisions, to say that they don't get to express a preference, I think not only is perverse in its own terms, but it actually deprives the voters of important information. So, yeah, I don't get that trend, and I wish it would change.
Thank you.
Well, we have one more question pending, so I think we'll have time to get to it. I would ask our caller to be as brief as possible. Hi, are you there, caller?
Yes, can you hear me?
Yep.
Okay, this is Margaret Little in Connecticut. It's a second question. You endorse incrementalism, as generally I do too as well, but how would this view of politics be able to embrace areas which need fundamental change? And I'm just going to throw out an example dear to my heart, which is I have been advocating for a consumption tax system for years, and because of the interests in government being so entrenched, that's a very difficult haul, although something I see possibly progressives and libertarians and other coalitions being able to at least intellectually embrace. How do you see your approach either ruling out such a change or assisting such a change?
Well, another great question. Thank you, Margaret. There's a bunch of stuff in my book, Governments and About This. Did I flack for that enough yet? Yours for $12 on Amazon. But when I say incrementalism is the name of the game, I mean usually not always. If we're lucky, once or twice in a decade, the stars align such that you can do a really big, important reform. You don't get many shots at that because you have to line up a sufficient critical mass of the public, the interest groups, and the parties. They don't all have to be perfectly aligned, but enough of them do. So in the 70s, you get a huge transportation deregulation. Very, very important, as Federalist Society members know. In the 80s, you get tax reform. Huge simplification of the tax code, a great thing. Also, there was a big Social Security package that year, which stabilized it, made it more fiscally sound. In the 90s, we would have had Social Security reform, a serious one, private accounts, I think, if not for the Lewinsky affair. And we did get a huge welfare reform, which was very important. The way you get these is when you get enough of a consensus to move and you get enough policy entrepreneurship, that's when it's especially important to be able to seize these opportunities by having leaders who can put these deals together and maneuver them through and pick up those spare votes that you absolutely must have by giving that guy this highway or protecting him from the primary or doing what you need to do for him or her. And I think the tragedy of where we are now is we almost had a big and I think significantly positive reform on immigration, where there was a strong national consensus and a whole lot of agreement. It slipped through our fingers because the leadership did not have the tools to put it through. So to me, the biggest single reason why it's important to have empowered leaders is to be able to grasp those opportunities because they do arise. And when they arise, they can make a huge difference.
Thank you.
Well, we're out of time, and on behalf of the Federalist Society, I want to thank both Steve Klein and Jonathan Rauch. Steve, do you have any final thoughts before we end the call?
No, I just really appreciate your time, John, and thank you so much for joining us. And again, the e-book is free for download. I hope anyone walking away from this teleform is certainly more enticed to read it.
Thank you for having me, and thank you for the marvelous questioners.
Fantastic. Well, again, the link to the book is on our website, and you can find the podcast of this teleform call post it on our website within a couple days in case you want to listen in again. So until next time, we're adjourned. Thank you all very much.
Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this practice group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at federalistsociety.org/multimedia.